You better come on in my kitchen. There's hard to be raining her do.
Come over here, kid, will you, sir? You never know, you might have to cook for 20 guys someday. You see, you start out with a little bit of oil. You fry some garlic. Then you throw in some tomatoes, tomato paste, you fry it, you make sure it doesn't stick. You got it to a boil, you shove in all your sausage and your meatballs. Huh? A little bit of wine. A little bit of sugar.
Delicious.
And that's my trick.
When the moon hits your eye like a bigger pizza pie, that's amore.
Enough. I'm so sick and tired of hearing you people talk about food, food, food. That's all anybody ever talks about is prosciutto, cheese, and fava beans. I'm drowning here.
Jesus Christ, take it easy.
We're not even engaged yet.
When you're married, you'll understand the importance of fresh produce. Mashed potatoes,
yeah. I eat with gusto, damn your bet, my country tis of thee. I eat for social progress, I eat for victory.
Delicious.
Stay hungry, stay hungry, stay hungry.
You want some more?
And good evening. Welcome to Mouthful, the Wine Country's Most Delicious Hour. I'm Mary Carroll, and I have the honor of substituting for Michelle Anna Jordan, who is back east at a family event this evening, but I'm delighted to be here with her fine guests. We're going to talk about a very, I won't say a provocative topic. I was going to say a spicy topic, but that's probably a little bit too much overkill, because tonight's topic is going to be spices, what they are, how you use them, how you store them, where they came from, and why they're special. And my guests in the studio tonight are from two local purveyors of fine spices. From the Sonoma Spice Company, we have Kimberly Cook Fallon. Kim, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And from the Savory Spice Shop, we have Pat Benfer and Cheryl, and I'm sorry, but I don't have your last name.
Etreide,
okay. I've learned the hard way that sometimes the easiest way to ask how find out how a person really pronounces their name is to ask them, and then you remember it.
Thank you.
Same thing with spelling, by the way. I know. I have a it's a pet peeve of mine is misspelled and mispronounced names, especially when it's Smith. You'd be surprised. At any rate, these ladies are here because we're going to be talking about spice, which is one of those topics that everybody uses and everybody thinks about, you know, just sort of in passing. But it's actually a very creative substance that can be used so many different ways. It's medicinal, it's culinary, it's aromatic. What are some of the other ways that spices are used? Medicine, food, scent?
Yes. preserving foods, too.
You can use preservative, spice to right. Preserve That's true.
Foods. Curing foods.
Oh, good point. Particularly when other methods of preservation were not available. And not just preservation, but enhancement. I guess that's the word I'm looking for. Yeah. It's not enough just to make it safe. You want to make it tasty.
Tasty.
Tasty. So actually, I'm going to ask each of you this question because I'm curious as to where people develop this type of interest. And Kim, I'll start with you. How did you become interested in spices?
Well, from cooking. I grew up cooking for my family, and I've always cooked, and I've cooked at home, and I really took a passion for making my own spice blends when I started having children around 20 years ago, because I wanted them to grow up liking the taste of real food. I knew that someday they'd discover chips, and they did. But in the meantime, they developed a real affinity for really good, wholesome food. And most of the spice blends you can buy in stores off the shelves are often laden with salt and sugar, anti-caking agents, colorings, and I just didn't want to subject my children to that. So I started crafting my own spice blends at home, and I started out with a few, and then a few became, you know, half a dozen bulletproof blends that I would always go to. And crafting them yourself and fresh grinding your seeds brings such a huge advantage to the aromas and the flavors that you're able to extract and employ into your cooking, and it was just night and day, and it's it's a lot of fun.
I'm going to out myself at this point as somebody who has no children, because the first thing that occurred to me was the idea that so often it's touted as a way to get picky eaters to eat is to involve them with the food preparation and, if possible, even the growing of the food, mm-hmm. the gardening, and kids seem to be much more likely to accept something that they've had a stake in. Is that true with spices as well? I mean, do you find that if you get your kids interested in picking what goes into the blend and grinding them and all that, that they're more likely?
No.
Not really?
No, not at all.
Oh.
But I would say that I've always had a garden, and my kids know where the compost pile is, and they've pulled their own carrots, and they pick their own kale to this day right off the plant and throw it in the blender for their smoothies. They have an intimate relationship with agriculture because we're blessed to live here in Sonoma County, which is an agricultural community on many levels, whether it be the food you eat, the wine you drink, the beer that's being crafted in the local brew houses and breweries. So there's just the whole culture of our community is steeped in agriculture, and the intimate relationship between growing, farming, picking, preparing, harvesting, and preserving foods is the life cycle that we enjoy.
Well, thank you. Pat, how about you? How did you get involved in spices?
Oh, how did I get involved in spices? I grew up with a Italian grandmother and grandfather, and so I had an opportunity to taste a lot of food and eat a lot of food back then when that wasn't really, the cuisine wasn't so readily available. And then I love to cook and garden, and I like ethnic foods. So I love to cook Moroccan and Thai and Cambodian and, you know, East Asian. And you couldn't find the spices that you needed here, even in California at that time. I'd open a cookbook and try to find something, and I was like, where am I going to get this stuff?
Is this why a lot more cookbooks I've noticed have started including mail order sources at the back of the mm-hmm. cookbook for things that are not readily available in wherever you happen to be?
Exactly. Most cities and most states, yes. So you, in order to cook those kind of foods, you need certain kinds of spices and herbs. And if you don't have a spice store near you, you're going to have to mail order them. So things like sumac and asafoetida and curry leaves and kaffir lime leaves and things like that, you can't get them in the grocery store. And most of the things, especially cinnamon, it's stale. There's not much aroma to them. There's not much taste to this cinnamon you buy in the grocery store. So it doesn't give the kind of flavor that you want from cinnamon, especially when you're doing a savory dish.
I'm glad you said that, because one of the questions that we'll be talking about later on is storage of spices, which I think many people either don't know about or think they know and don't, mm-hmm. which is even worse.
Yeah.
Cheryl, how about you?
Well, about 15 years ago, I was part of a book club, culinary dinner club.
Mm-hmm.
So we would read books that had recipes in them and had ethnic foods in them. And same, like as Pat said, you know, you go to make these ethnic dishes like Moroccan food or Arabic food from the different books, and you could never either find them in the grocery store, or if they did have them, you would spend a small fortune to buy them to make the dishes for that cooking club night or that, you know, the book club night. So about 15 years ago, I really started being very interested in ethnic types of foods and then being able to find those spices and be able to cook with them.
This is interesting, because what I'm hearing as we talk to all of you is that there's this sort of spectrum of reasons for being involved, everything from dinners for a select group to wanting to raise children and making sure that they're learning about real food. I mean, I say slow food, but that's kind of a catchphrase. But different tastes, different flavors, different ways of preparing things. I know all of you have establishments where you purvey spices. I'm going to refer to you as spice purveyors, because that reminds me of, you know, Eastern merchants back in the days of Marco Polo. And, of course, those were very important people because they had the secret to preserving mm-hmm. food.
Yeah.
And one of the things I'd like to know is, once again, Kim, we'll start with you. Are your spices organic, or does it matter?
The lion's share of my spices I am able to source organically. But given that they're agricultural products and not everybody is in certification, there's some limits. Like, for example, I really am able to source almost everything organically from a company called High Quality Organics in bulk, and then I mill them fresh each week for market. But then on the other hand, I choose not to buy certified organic Jamaican allspice because I want Jamaican allspice from Jamaica. They're not in certification. I'm pretty certain that they don't spray. They don't have an agricultural culture.
But they also don't have a Jamaican Board of Agricultural exactitude.
And then a lot of seed crops simply aren't sprayed. It's fruit crops that are mostly sprayed or largely sprayed because they don't need to spray it. But anyway, so in certain cases, I source from the country or location of origin where they really did start out and grow to get the most authentic flavors. Some things I get from the Middle East just simply are there's no organic farming in Iraq and Basra and Oman for the Middle Eastern ingredients that I love to use. And so, and sometimes I just buy in such small quantities that I can't.
It's not practical.
I can't afford to buy the minimum amount from the organic companies.
Well, particularly since, as we're going to talk about, there is a finite shelf life for some of these things.
Right, and there's been crop failure where I was just denied organic turmeric for 4 months because the crop was exhausted. The demand was higher than the – it takes several years to become certified organic. It's a process.
Right.
And so you can't always have – the nature of agriculture depends on crop success. And there are such things as crop failures.
Oh, I know. So my garden's been the subject of a number of them.
As everybody knows about the price of pepper. It used to be reasonable, and now it's unreasonable.
Same thing with coffee.
Yes, exactly.
A lot of people are finding that out the hard way.
Yes.
So, Pat and Cheryl, how about you? Are yours organic, and where do you source yours from?
We have 60 different spice merchants throughout the world that we source our spices from. Like Kim said, most of our spices, or probably all of them, haven't been sprayed. But we do have a few, 20 maybe, certified organic, which costs the grower and farmer a lot of money to go through all that certification.
Oh, yeah. The overhead is tremendous.
It is. And it gets passed on to the consumer. And half the time, the organics aren't as good as
flavor isn't as good, and they don't look as nice.
No, they don't.
The organics are not as bright and vivid in color. They're usually a little browner and... So it's
a toss-up.
It's a toss-up, yeah. And, like Kim was saying, in those foreign countries, the farmers just can't afford all the certification, even if it was available. It's just so costly to be certified organic. Yeah.
And the one important thing that we do is that everything we bring into this country is brought in whole.
Okay.
None of it is brought in ground. Ever.
So the raw materials come in and then they get ground and blended.
And mixed every week.
So you guys are sort of the equivalent of what used to be called a compounding pharmacy.
Is that it?
Yeah. It's rather that's what pharmacies used to do. Yeah. Rather than like just selling things over the counter, they actually had people with pharmacy licenses who would take the raw materials, the drug of some sort, and they would grind it, the old mortar and pestle thing. Yeah. Yeah. They would grind it and put it together in the right proportions and make up pills.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, one of the things I think is important is to... I manufacture my products fresh every Wednesday, and I sell them on Thursday and Friday and Saturday and Sunday. And so my stuff's fresh milled every single week, and that's a huge difference from grinding your fresh pepper or your mustard seed or your fennel seed or your coriander, whatever you're grinding. The moment you grind it, it just jumps right out of, the grinder at you. It smells so great, and then it dissipates slowly over time. So stuff that you don't know when it was manufactured or how long it's, how fresh it was is a big deal. And that's one of the allures of, I put out aroma jars so people could smell. This is what it really can smell like. This is how great it can be.
Do any of you sell whole spices so that people can grind their own?
Constantly.
We do.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we have hundreds of whole spices. The other thing that's the allure of spices is to be able to toast the spices before you grind them. They change their complexity and their taste and their smell once you just throw a combination of them in a little pan and dry roast them right before you use them and then grind them and use them right fresh. We have a lot of customers that come in and buy whole spices, take them home, roast them, and then grind them, and then use them that way. It's so wonderful to have fresh spices, whole spices, to be able to
toast and grind yourself.
Well, yeah, it's called blooming your spices.
Yes.
And what it does is the heat on a dry, you know, a dry surface forces the oils out through the husk and the skin, and it brings out the aromatics, and so that they become much more charming right away.
Sort of like toasting nuts, right?
Exactly.
The same principle.
The oils. The oils, yeah.
You know, it's funny because when I was talking about the compounding pharmacies, I was telling these ladies earlier off mic that I had a story about spice and a medical professional who was not from this country, and a relative of mine was doing her rundown because she was one of his patients, and telling him about all the different drugs she took. And one of the things that she mentioned was that she takes ginger capsules. And he asked her, why? Why do you take ginger? And she said, well, it's a digestive aid, and it works better than many of the, you know, regular medicines, and it's cheaper. And
yeah.
Anyway, he was shaking his head vigorously, apparently, and saying, no, you eat ginger. You drink ginger. You know, you don't take ginger, right?
Don't digest it.
And he just didn't, for the life of him, understand why anybody would use ginger as a medicinal. And yet, that's been one of the folk remedies for a long time, hasn't it? I mean, not just ginger, but many spices.
Yes, and we actually have an Ayurvedic doctor that comes to our establishment once in a while and actually gives 6 weeks classes on the medicinal uses of all the spices. It's a great class.
I have to ask him, you mentioned that you use these sort of bloom jars as a...
Aroma jars. Aroma jars and blooming spices, two
right.
separate things.
Sorry. But as I take it that's, I don't want to say a come on, but that's one of the attractions where you have people who perhaps would not have even thought about buying spices. And
well, yeah, I mean, you can't really, short of cooking the food so that people know what it tastes like.
Right.
The only thing they can do is smell it. And once you've smelled, you know, relatively freshly ground spice blends, and then you compare it to what they're used to buying off the, you know, grocery, you know, big grocery stores, they immediately like, oh my gosh, that smells like the food I had at this Asian restaurant or this ethnic restaurant. And we're blessed in this area with a multicultural community and fabulous access to all sorts of authentic ethnic foods. And the more people are exposed to that, the more people want to try and bring that home and recreate it. And when you buy spice mixes in Safeway or just big grocery stores that have been there for God knows how long, many of them, you'll notice the first or second ingredient is salt or sugar, which is both heavy and extremely inexpensive. It really forces out a lot of flavor. And you reach your salt threshold before you ever get to the ethnic flavor pow that you're
right.
looking for. And so people just give up and they never get to it. And then they go back out to the restaurants and they eat the food that they love and have a difficult time recreating it. And it's also a lot of the blends are very complex, and trying to fool around with it as a novice is fun, but sometimes you just ruin your meal. Whereas if you can buy a well-crafted, well-balanced spice blend, you can't overdo it too much because it is the flavor. It is already in harmony with the food that you're cooking. And so long as the salt isn't there to ruin your experience and halt your ability to integrate spices into your cuisine and start to like, oh, yeah, I like that. Maybe I like a little more. Maybe I like a little more of that. Oh, if I add a little lemon, that's going to make it a little brighter. And people can start to take command and control of their diet at home with all the beautiful produce that they have access to in our farmers markets.
You know, this is sounding a lot like the musical analogy is when you first learn music. Yeah, it'd be really nice to write your own and kind of play, but you don't start there. You perhaps look at the sheet music that your instructor gives you, and you learn the scales, and you do this, and you play things that people have already crafted, people who knew what they were doing.
Right.
Well, and then if you go out and try to buy each spice that goes into these blends, you will spend a small fortune.
There is that.
So, and then you have to buy a certain quantity. So here you've got 25 or 30 spices that go into this blend, and some of them have that much, instead of going into a shop that has it already blended, and instead of paying $30, you're going to pay $5 or $6, and you're going to get a couple of ounces. So that works out a lot better, too.
We're going to take a little musical break here, and actually our song stems from the fact that, Kim, you were talking about sugar and salt. And sugar, of course, traditionally is one of those things that everybody has seen as desirable, well, except dieters. and spice traditionally was the same thing, too. That was why it was so highly prized, because it did so many things. It was medicinal, and it was aromatic, and it preserved food. And so this is a song that's kind of a throwback from the last century, but it had to do with the fact that spice was considered a desirable commodity.
So.
And we're back with Mouthful, the Wine Country's Most Delicious Hour here on KRCB-FM. We're talking to three spice mavens here, and we've been talking about how one becomes interested in spices and where you get them and the certification process and some of the inherent hazards in trying to be organic, which is not just spices, by the way. I think that's any produce. At least I've heard that. One of the questions we were talking about during the break was the way of grinding spices. And this is something I didn't know. Apparently there are different methods. Do they yield different results, or is it the flavor different, or does it matter?
Well, I'll say that a lot of things matter. When you mentioned a mortar and pestle, and that's really fun, but how much can you get? I'm selling to lots of people. You cannot manufacture with a mortar and pestle the volume that I go through. But at home, you can do that. Then there are different kinds of grinders. There are burr grinders, which have a constant they have a uniform result. So I have a dedicated burr grinder just for black pepper. So I don't have large and powdered size granules of black pepper. It's uniform. Then there's all kinds of coffee grinders, which work great. But then again, you're going to outgrow your coffee grinder volume pretty quickly when you're manufacturing pounds of spice blends weekly. So Nutribullet works really well. You can do two or three cups at a time. Then there's things like certain things that are almost impossible to grind into a powder and that require a stone grinder as you would make flour, and that's cumin seed right there. You can't grind cumin seed with into a powder with a mortar and pestle, and you can't do it with a coffee grinder either. So it's one thing I do choose to buy because I don't have a stone. I don't even know what they're called, but for grinding flour, the stone grinders that they use to make flour.
Okay.
Then that being said,
that's basically
that's kind of what we need.
Ladies, how about you? How do you prepare your spices? Same thing.
They get grounded in Denver, Colorado, because we are a franchise.
That's true.
So they do get grounded in Colorado. When we talk to people about buying whole spices, most of them know what to do with them. And there's occasion that we go back there and we have a burr grinder and we do grind them for them, because sometimes, especially chilies, they ask for ground chilies, and not all the chilies that we have are ground. So we'll go back and grind them. Fenugreek is another one that you can't really grind that very easily. You need to soak it overnight or soak it for a couple of hours because it is such a hard seed. So we tell people, you know, you need to soak this before you grind it up so it'll be easy to do. They grind more, I would say, in probably 20 pounds at a time back there. So they've got all the grinders back there and actually a room where they do all the grinding.
Now, what I'd like to do next is talk to all of you and give you about 5 minutes to talk about your establishment, your store, your clientele, your business philosophy, your name, how it got there. And just in the spirit of fairness, I'm going to go the other way around the table and start with you and Cheryl, Pat.
Oh, go ahead, Cheryl. You're first.
So we, Pat and I have been, we have owned our store for 4 years. We're right downtown on 5th and D, and we last year opened another store in Sonoma, in the Sonoma Marketplace Shopping Center, right where, kind of two doors down from Whole Foods.
Okay.
My daughters, how we got introduced first to Savory Spice Shop is my daughters now live out in Denver, and knowing that I love to cook took me to a Savory, and what so impressed me about the spice store out there was the freshness of the spices, and then the variety. We have over 400 whole herbs and spices. We have then, because we grind and blend them all in very small quantities, we make 160 different handcrafted seasonings. So when I was out there and we walked into the store, it just smelled wonderful. And just the freshness of everything. And Mike Johnston, who is our founder, is a fabulous blend master. He crafts the most awesome blends for us. He just came out with lime salt.
Okay,
it's just fabulous.
I think I'm getting the idea here. Yeah, Pat. I know you probably have things to add too.
I do. let's see. You asked what our customer base is like.
Mm-hmm.
We sell to a lot of restaurants and chefs. We sell to a lot of men. Customers come in and go, boy, I bet the women love this store. And actually, Men love it just as much or more than women do, and they buy a lot of spices and blends for us. They love to barbecue. They love to cook. And they cook for big parties.
The reason I'm smiling is that the gentleman who is the normal engineer for this show and his predecessors is the word I want, the guy who hosts the shows immediately before that were once talking, and something happened and Michelle wasn't able to come, and they ended up having to fill the hour, and they did this impromptu show which they sort of affectionately referred to as dude food because it was, you know, guys and barbecue and what they use.
Exactly.
And that's exactly the kind of thing they were talking about.
They come in, they get 5 pounds of cumin, 1 pound of this, 2 pounds of that, brown sugar and honey powder, and they make their own barbecue blends and just have a blast.
We've had a great opportunity to introduce spices to the younger generation. We've been invited to numerous elementary schools and had some elementary schools bring their children, students into our store. And so that's really fun to introduce the next generation to fresh,
not just
spices.
Cooking, but cooking, cooking with flair.
And the history of it.
And the history of
The history of where they came from, what they were worth, how they got here, where, you know, the Silk Road, the whole nine yards.
So, Kim, I mean, obviously yours is a different perspective because, for one thing, you have a sole proprietorship, and you take yours to farmers markets. Is that correct?
Yeah, I started my business here in Sonoma County in the fertile grounds of the farmers market community back in 2010. And I started out with about 6 blends and a lot of single spices. And my product line grew directly from customers asking me to make something else for fish, to make something else for beef. Could you put something, you know, do you have something that goes in an Asian direction? I want something hot and spicy. Can you make a jerk? And to preface that, the cornerstone of my product line is that I do not use any salt, sugar, or wheat. They're pure premium spices so that people can go home and really go at it without fillers and not feel ripped off as well. So my product line has grown directly out of response to the community's desire for the convenience of premium fresh ground spices, because people still want a little bit of convenience. It's almost cheating, but it's not really, because you're really using real food.
It's not cheating.
No, but people really do want the convenience. There was a time when I sold all the components to make curries, thinking people would want to go home and play with that. That did not fly. People wanted a curry powder, or people wanted, you know, they, just like the other ladies were saying, you know, not everybody's going to go out and buy juniper berry and achiote and grind their own, you know, to make spice blends. Some of these ingredients are hard to find, and then they sit in your cabinet for the next year until you use them again.
The other thing, I'm sorry.
So you might have, if you live in this county, you might have recognized me from my first business name, Cook Spices, which is my actual name. My maiden name is Cook. And I started out with that. And when I realized after 2 or 3 years my product line had grown from 6 or 7 to over 35 products, and some of which are just seasonal, then I was like, you know what? This has got legs. People love this. People want this. I'm really good at it. And so I went to trademark my name, and it's taken. So my attorney advised me last summer, if you're going to grow, you need to protect yourself, and you can't continue as Cook Spices. So we did a massive search to find a name that was appropriate, meaningful, and reflective of the community.
And that's available.
And available, and that's what Sonoma Spice Company is. So now I'm trademark pending with that. And I'll also say that the blending and making of spice blends really comes from my background. I mean, my bachelor's degree is in environmental science, and I'm steeped in agriculture. My master's degree is in enology and viticulture, and I spent years prior to this teaching sensory evaluation of wines and blind tasting, having my students taste blind and just describe aromas and flavors. And what everybody doesn't know how to express is what it is that they like in a wine. They had wrong terminology, but what it ultimately is balance. Human beings like balanced flavors, and to be able to give people the language to say it has a twang, well, is that acidity or is that astringent? Or, you know, it's flabby, well, does that mean that it's out of balance with regard to its you know, the acidity in it is too high or too low, it's not in balance. And so that gave me the skill set to make spice blends that were very appealing. And once I got on a roll, then, you know, it's a challenge that I love, and the product line is not ending anytime soon.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
Now, when you said students, that suddenly triggered something, and I'd like to go back to you guys for a minute when you talked about how you get kids to come in. I mean, obviously, I'm assuming when you were saying students, especially with Enology, you were talking about people who are 21.
I'm talking about a lot of retired people.
Right.
And people who are newly discovering wine, and they can afford it, and they have the confidence.
But not third graders.
Right. Oh, no, no. No, no. I have taught in elementary schools. I've taught at the charter school here. I taught a food and nutrition class because, to me, the why to cook is just as compelling as the how to cook and what to cook. You want to cook because you want to feel good. You want to have a relationship with your food. It's intrinsic to humans to be well-nourished and take care of each other. It's part of our life. You know, we have to eat and we have to grow, and it's, you know, family meals and all that come together over the table. And so being able to just know where your food comes from, who's growing it, how to prepare it, how to steward it properly in your kitchen, and then receive the nourishment, share it with your family. It's a good thing. It's part of my philosophy that's on the back of my packaging.
And that's what I'd like to do, is going back to you two for a minute. You said that you have schools coming in now, or do you go out to the schools, or how do you do that?
We do both. Yeah, and actually the junior college also.
Really?
Yeah, some of their cooking classes or their cooking schools. Uh-huh.
You kind of take the show on the road, as it was?
We do, yes.
What's the general reaction, especially from younger children? Because when Kim was talking about using the terminology, you know, flabby, and all I could think of was kids saying yucky and not really knowing what that means, because that can mean, you know, 10 different things to 10 different children. But what's the usual reaction of children who are
They're really interested, especially when they can taste, feel, smell, and Sherry does a great job of telling them the cost that used to
the history of spices is just really fascinating. So taste and smell, then we kind of talk about what a spice used to cost in the olden day. You know, if you were an old traditional old world spice merchant, what cloves would have cost, how long it took you to travel to procure that, and then do some real visual, like, you know, an ounce of peppercorns, what it used to cost, you know, compare it to now modern gold, and then we bring out a big bowl of peppercorns and then tell them, you know, that this bowl, if we were an old spice merchant, you know, we would have been able to buy a home with this bowl of pepper. And so it's there, you know, you watch their eyes get really, you know,
big. Their jaws drop.
Yeah, we do a lot, you know, a lot of education on what the old world spices were, you know.
How they used them.
Mm-hmm.
And Kim, what I started to say earlier, and I apologize for cutting you off, is when you talked about how, you know, you had all the components for curry powder, and then you realized that people didn't want the components. They wanted a curry powder.
Right. They want the convenience. The convenience is a huge
And I think I've seen some of that. Not so much. I mean, there is. It's not like there's every blend of spice, although, you know, there are quite a few. But the two that I've noticed that seem to have really gone mainstream are pumpkin pie spice and apple pie spice. And there may even be different combinations depending on who the vendor is. But those seem to be, you know, sort of widely accepted, that if you're going to make an apple pie or you're going to make a pumpkin pie and you want it to taste like what you expect those to taste, if you use something labeled that, it'll come out. Whereas probably the same thing is true with curry, except there are so many variations of curry. But I think what you're talking about is true. I mean, sometimes it's a necessity. You know, people don't have time, and yet they don't want to just go and get a, you know, frozen dinner.
Well, yeah, a lot of people, you know, don't have a nutmeg grinder, and that's key to both of those. Just cinnamon and nutmeg in an apple pie that's pretty simple and wonderful. Pumpkin pie spice is a little more complex because it usually involves ginger. Mine involves orange peel as well. But you want the ingredients to be fresh. And gosh, like my pumpkin pie spice is so versatile. Not mine, but they all are. I mean, I sell a lot of it in the winter for curried pumpkin soup to finish your soup with. My kids put it on chai tea or you know, steamed lattes. I even use pumpkin pie spice in my holiday spice cake. It's kind of crazy, but it's true.
A few years ago, Cooking Light had a great apple pie, and they used pumpkin pie spice in their apple pie. And so now that's what I do. When I make an apple pie, I'll use our pumpkin pie spice. It gives it a little bit of a different flavor, complexity.
And we use Chinese five spice to make pumpkin pie. And it's amazing. don't have to use pumpkin pie spice to make pumpkin pie.
Actually, at this point, I have a purely self-serving question because when we're talking about apples and apple pie spices and so forth, I'd like to ask each of you in turn, what would be your recommended spice blend for making applesauce, especially Gravenstein applesauce?
Just a really good cinnamon.
Cinnamon.
a Ceylon cinnamon or a Saigon cinnamon. Just a really good cinnamon. Apple, I don't know. Applesauce is best basic.
Okay.
It's a pure food. A little cinnamon and I don't think you need to go much further than that.
Yeah.
Because you want to taste the apples, and the cinnamon just complements the apples. You get too complex and you're getting away from the elemental gorgeousness of our local Gravenstein apples.
And truthfully, sometimes a little bit of butter.
Well, I in the interest of full disclosure, I will say that I asked the question because last week I purchased a 40-pound box of the elemental gorgeousness of our local apples.
You've got some cooking to do.
Exactly. Apple butter, applesauce. I've already made an apple tart.
I think one recipe, old recipe, they just added a tiny bit of butter to their applesauce when they were cooking it down. And it just, a little pat of butter just brings out a little saltiness, a little creaminess. So add a little butter.
I've heard of that in jam. But
well, and also butter, a lot of the volatile compounds, the aromatic compounds, are also oil soluble, and so you want to, that's true with a lot of the health virtues of some of the spices people want. The active ingredients are fat soluble; they can't be taken up by the body in the absence of oil. Like in turmeric, the curcumin is an oil soluble compound. Same thing with the cinnamonic acid in cinnamon; you need to have a little bit of fat there to absorb it, The mouthfeel of spices and butter. As a matter of fact, it's an excellent vehicle for tasting spices. Is just to get a unsalted butter, melt it, and bloom your spices in that, and taste it. You'll get a more of a. It's easier to taste it that way.
I'm starting to salivate.
Dinner's at 9 o'clock. Yeah,
right,
tonight.
Exactly. Another topic, then, I was talking about this a little bit before the show started, simply because I know it's something that's a source of confusion to many people is. What is the difference? Well, I guess we should say, let's talk about the similarities and the differences between herbs and spices, because I think to many people, they're sort of one big bucket, including salt. And we've already established that salt is not a spice. It's not an herb either. It's actually a mineral, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a seasoning, but that's about where the similarity ends. But what is the difference between herbs and spices?
Well, I think of herbs as plant materials that are leafy. Mm-hmm. And I think of spices being seeds and nuts that need to be ground.
Seeds, nuts, any type of bark, any type of root, that's a spice.
And a pod.
And a pod.
Like cardamom's a pod. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And cinnamon's a bark, right?
Cinnamon's a bark. Yep.
And then I guess cumin is a seed.
Seed.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are probably some plants that have, I mean, they give rise to both an herb and a spice, right?
Yeah, coriander. Coriander is a seed, and then cilantro is the leafy green.
I think that's the only one, though, that is like that, where it gives both.
Really?
I think so.
That's true, because I guess I've never heard of a cinnamon flower.
No.
Mm-mm. And a nutmeg is a pod, right?
It's a beautiful pod with mace wrapped around it.
Oh, and that's a good point. Maybe it doesn't have an herb, but it actually has the same plant has two spices that
exactly.
come from it. And that's why the two flavors are somewhat similar. But as I recall, mace is slightly...
Exotic.
And it's a little bit more muted.
It's really expensive.
That too.
They have to peel it off of the nutmeg.
Right.
And
I mean,
so
I guess
you get a big nutmeg, and then you get a little filament of the mace around the outside.
The surface area of mace compared to the total... Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see.
But a little bit goes a long ways.
That's quite true.
You don't need a whole lot of mace.
What about storing spices? I mean, we've already heard that you should buy them fresh. You should grind them if you possibly can.
Mm-hmm.
How long are they good for?
If you grind them, if you get them freshly ground, they will last a year. If they're stored in a nice container, hopefully not near the sun or the heat.
Do you recommend freezing them?
No.
No. No, you think of what degrades a spice, and they lose their aroma in the presence of oxygen in air, so you want to keep them airtight, and they lose their color when they're light struck, so keep them out of the sunlight, and also keep wildly fluctuating temperatures from accelerating both of those processes.
Don't put them on top of the stove.
No,
yeah,
no,
that, you know, that's where you, people used to.
I know that's
their
what I'm
spices. Their spice rack was, you know, mounted behind the stove. It's the worst place to keep them.
And as far as how long spices last, what I try and tell people is, hopefully, you want your spices to last a full year because, generally speaking, spices are harvested annually, and you hope you don't run out before the next harvest.
Oh,
and after the second harvest comes, then you've got something that's older than what's fresher. And so, basically, but if you're keeping it whole in seeds for, in, you know, keeping it as seeds and not grinding it, those things will last for a long time. The viability of seeds, can, you know, for mustard can be like 50 years. But if you're storing it properly, you get a lot of bang for fresh grinding your. Seeds that you keep. But yeah, the year is the rule of thumb because that's how agriculture works.
That's true. I hadn't thought about that. And especially now, you know, where with the ubiquity of just about anything, any time of the year, you go to the grocery store and, oh, I want cinnamon or I want
broccoli, lettuce, all the things. We've got a global agricultural community. Not that you want to be eating food from the southern hemisphere, but when can you not get grapes? You can get grapes year round. When can you not get broccoli? It's, you know, it's a cool climate crop, but we still get it in July.
What are the growing seasons, for lack of a better term, for spices? I mean, or does it differ by the spice and where it comes from?
It
will differ from where it grows.
And most of the spices grow either above, north or south of the equator, about 7 to 8 degrees.
Oh, okay, so not even between the two tropics, not between Cancer and Capricorn, it's like half that distance?
Yeah, pretty much.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, and now they, you know, because we are such a global world, they are, you know, where the spices originated, you know, they've been able to propagate them in other warmer climates, where, you know, with nutmeg, you only used to be able to get that down in Indonesian, those Indonesian islands down there, those really remote little islands. But now they've been able to propagate it, and they grow it in Grenada and all over the place. You know, so the warmer climates. And that's why, that's really what has caused spices to be so reasonably priced instead of so expensive, is that the availability now is huge.
And the ability to grow it someplace other than where it was originally.
Where it was originally stuck.
And the same thing is true with coffee, isn't it?
I believe so.
Yeah.
Which is not a spice, even though it's...
It's a bean.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, it's not a seed. It's just
a magic bean.
Oh, that's for sure, yes. Nectar of the gods. But it isn't a flavoring agent, I guess, in the same way that when we're traditionally talking about spices, it's...
It's not considered a spice, as far as I know.
No, I don't think it is.
No, but there are a lot of dry rubs that use coffee.
That's true.
Which is tricky to do because you generally... A lot of dry rubs involve grilling, and grilling involves burning, and burning makes
coffee
is bitter.
Terrible.
Exactly, and so it's hard. It's tricky to make a high quality coffee blend, which people ask for all the time. Which you can make lovely blends, but once people throw it on the grill, you can have a result that's not anticipated or not intended, and then they just think it's a terrible blend.
Which is too bad because it's not the it's the execution, not the...
Right. It could be a finishing spice. It should be a finishing spice if it's going to have coffee in it, because you can get a lot of flavors. Although, these ladies might have...
We've got some amazing coffee blends for meats and things, and I've used them on my barbecue, and they've come absolutely fabulous. So actually, what they do is they caramelize really nice. If you've got the right combinations of them, that coffee, amidst some sugar, will make a wonderful caramelization out on a piece of meat or steak that you really...
It goes to show that there really is something for everybody, because everybody's taste buds are different, and everybody's budget's different. Everybody's,
everybody's palate evolves differently. No one's born with a taste, you know, a preference for scotch. That's something that's acquired. And some people culturally have flavor profiles that they grew up with that are natural to them. And
The only one that's really seems to be innate is sugar. I mean, because...
Sweet.
Yeah, and it's because it's safe.
Exactly.
Traditionally, if it was sweet, it meant it wasn't going to poison you.
Mother's milk.
Sweet.
Sweet and umami right there.
We're going to take one more short break. This is going back to what we were talking about, the difference between herbs and spices, because although the topic of the next song is really herbs rather than spices, it's still one that's, I think, many people are fond of.
Scarborough Fair. parsley, sage, rosemary, and thyme. Remember me to one who lives there. She once was a true love of mine. Tell her to make me a cadaveric shirt, a deep forest green. Parsley, sage, rosemary, and thyme. Strands and polishes a fan, she'll be a true love of mine. Tell her to reap it in a sickle of blazing in scarlet battalion. Parsley, sage, rosemary, and thyme.
Sorry, I had to wait for that last little note of Scarborough Fair. That's always been one of my favorites. And we were talking earlier about how, you know, we tried to pick music that was somewhat topical, and a number of people had said, well, you've got to play Scarborough Fair. And I said, those are herbs. They aren't spices. But since these ladies have informed us all that there is a relationship between the different parts of the plant, we thought that that was appropriate. We were just talking about how different spice blends can be used for things other than perhaps what the original blender had anticipated. Kim, you said that something that was just absolutely sparkling on fish turned out to remind somebody else of potato salad.
Yeah, exactly. I made a blend called Delicious for Fishes with salmon in mind. That was my mission. And one of my first customers, the day after I released it, came up and smelled it, looked at me, looked at the name, just, you know, pondered it for a moment, and then looked at me and said, this smells like potato salad. And sure enough, those herbs are all, those spices are perfect with potato salad and cabbage. Play with, so a lot of different foods play with very nicely with some very similar seasonings. And customers can be really creative and enlighten me tremendously, and I love to hear that.
Pat, Cheryl, if you found the same thing with your customers, do any of them come back and say, oh, by the way, I tried this in XYZ and...
Absolutely. And we actually tell them also we've got a pork rub that makes wonderful peach galette. It's just amazing.
Well, peaches and pork go together.
They
peaches
do.
Peaches and sweet. I mean, pork is a lends itself to sweet.
A little spicy, a little sweet.
Oh, yeah. And I made some yellow plum jam because one of the people here at the station had a abundance of yellow plums. And it turned out a little bit waterier than I would have preferred. I was doing no pectin. And I presented it to somebody whose immediate reaction was, oh, sauce for pork chops.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Oh, I hadn't thought about that, but that's true. I guess you could do that with spice.
My husband's favorite secret ingredient in coleslaw is Chinese five spice.
Hmm.
He just came up with that. We were doing an event at the store, and
You said it needed some zip?
He needed some zip, and I don't know how we came up with the Chinese five spice, but that now that's his secret ingredient in coleslaw. So very, very different. You wouldn't think of that for a coleslaw, but it's really good.
No, that, I hadn't thought about that, but that's true. I'm listening to all of you and thinking,
yeah,
great,
and you know what?
Great ideas.
One of the most interesting comments that I get are from people who are vegan or vegetarian, because I sell as much of my spice blends to, you know, grilling aficionados that want to throw a slab of meat on the grill as I do to vegans and vegetarians that need to spice up their world dramatically. And they'll come back and like, oh my gosh, your Moroccan blend isn't just for the lamb that you talked about. Try it on yams. And now actually I sell mountains of it for roasted yams at the holidays or yams all year round.
Or you throw a slab of portobello mushroom or something on the grill.
Yeah, a slab of mushroom.
Exactly.
On there,
yeah, those Moroccan spices do kind of cross over because they're warm and sweet and then savory too at the same time. They make a nice crossover.
Yeah, so thank you all my vegetarian and vegan customers for bringing me to new heights of cooking.
Well, I think more and more people are approaching not necessarily vegetarianism or veganism, but you know, with health conditions, you know, heart conditions and diabetes and what have you, or even some variation. I have a niece who's a pescatarian.
My daughter's pescatarian.
Yeah, but you know, poultry and meat are right out. So you get creative with how you spice things.
You do.
And so we've got about 5 minutes left. So what I'd like to do is ask each one of you, is there anything else our listeners should know either about spices or about where they can find you?
Don't be afraid to experiment and have fun cooking. You know, it's enjoy the process of cooking. And then enjoy sharing a good meal with friends and family. That is, I think that's one of the things we enjoy the most with our customers is they come in to, you know, they have all their recipes and they're making this wonderful meal for friends and family. And we just so much enjoy working with them.
That's great. Pat, how about you?
Just have fun. You know, cooking should be a joy and fun. And we, like Sherry said, get customers come in, and they not only talk about it, they bring in samples to us.
Yeah.
Food.
Well, that's good to know because there's an entire generation out there that has no idea how to cook. They've never been taught, and either in school or at home, and I think they're afraid of it.
That's a very interesting point because traditionally the culture of cooking is passed down from generation to generation, but now there's a huge gap because your kids are going to go off to college, they're going to start careers, they're going to travel if they're lucky, and then by the time they want to settle down to have a family or if they want to or nest in any way that they see fit and start cooking for themselves, I'm not going to remember their names. I mean,
and that presupposes
that culture, I'm not going to be cooking with them every day. So there's a gap there, and I think that's an important point to somehow figure out a way to pass down the cultural traditions that are valuable to humankind. And I started writing about this long before I started doing the spices. I think that's a really meaningful and valuable skill set to pass on and share. So it's good to people keep writing cookbooks and talking about it.
It's critical because, I mean, it used to be they had, you know, back in the day, they had home economics classes and many stay-at-home parents were cooks. Well, now there are many households where there is no stay-at-home parent by necessity.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
You know,
we give a lot of, that's what we spend most of our time with our customers is teaching them, you know, how to cook this and how to cook that and walking them through the steps. And we have hundreds of recipes. So sometimes it can be very overwhelming when you walk into our store as to what to do with these. And we've got hundreds of recipes that we set people out on, you know, to our Thai green curries and our some of our Moroccan seasonings and even some just as simple as fajitas and tacos, some great recipes for that. But they get a lot of, our staff provide a lot of hands-on cooking help for
we
people.
We make sure that when we hire our employees that they definitely have a passion for food and cooking. They know what spices and how to use them. And it's amazing how many times we tell people how to go home and cook something. And it's really rewarding when they come back. And they'll just come in the store and go, that was the best. Thank you.
And Kim, do you hand out recipes with your spices as well?
I used to hand out recipes, but now I direct them to my blog. And I'll just say this, is that the spice blends that I make are designed to provide multitasking convenience with delicious results. So you can have fun and cooking and take care of yourself and nourish each other. And now my spices are available online. I have an e-commerce website, www.sonomaspicecompany.com, where you can go online, order spices, and they'll be shipped out 2 days after you order.
Okay, and how about, do you guys have a website?
We absolutely do.
It's www.savoryspiceshop.com. But then you can also find us on the corner of 5th and D in downtown Santa Rosa, and now in Sonoma at the Whole Foods Shopping Center.
And I'm in the Santa Rosa Community Farmers Market year-round on Saturdays, and I'm in the Windsor Farmers Market on Sunday mornings, and I'm off and on in the Occidental Bohemian Farmers Market on Friday nights, and you'll find me at the Heirloom Festival and...
All right.
Around town.
Well, want to thank all of you for coming in. I hope everybody who's listening out there, if you have any questions about how to use spices, you now have some great resources, and you heard their websites. You can go in, hear about some of the new stuff, things you never heard of, and find out some ideas about how to use it. And then there's a phrase that I love from one of my favorite musical movies. It's take the music where you find it and then take it somewhere else, meaning take what you've
great.
Got and then
yeah,
build on it.
Wonderful.
I think that's what we're saying here. You know, take the spices where you find them, and then take it somewhere else. Thank you all.
Thank you. Really appreciate your being here.
You have been listening to Mouthful, the Wine Country's Most Delicious Hour. And be sure and join us again next week at 7 o'clock when Michelle will be back.
Children, it is plain but true. God knows if a preacher preaches long enough.
Mouthful, the Wine Country's Most Delicious Hour, is produced and hosted by Michelle Anna Jordan, who also selects Mouthful's music. Live episodes are engineered by Michael Young and occasionally by Mary Moore Campagna. Mark Fuller is Mouthful's recording and post-production engineer. Podcasts are available at iTunes and krcb.org. For more information, to suggest a guest, and to find out how to be a guest yourself, email catsmilk@sonic.net or send a message via Mouthful's Facebook page.